Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back, Sports to the Max, News Talk 830 WCCO. The Minnesota Wild made a trade today. Charlie Coyle, many of you familiar with, goes to Boston, his hometown team, for Ryan Donato, someone that we don't know a lot about. So I bring in somebody that knows a lot about both of the above and knows a lot about the NHL. He is sourced like no one else that I know. Brian Lawton, thank you for giving us a few minutes tonight.
My pleasure, Mike. You know that.
Well, I always enjoy visiting with you about a number of topics, but let's get to the one germane right now. We all talked about, will the Wild make a deal before the deadline? And Charlie Coyle's name mentioned among others, but his name has been mentioned a lot over the last couple of years. What's your take on Coyle and value they got in return?
My take on Charlie Coyle is universally with every player I've ever talked to over there on the Wild and other players that know him, is they absolutely love him as a human being. He's just first class. The Minnesota Wild are clearly going to miss that element that he brought to the locker room on a daily basis. In terms of his performance, I think he's a good player, and I think he's one of those guys that's really going to hit his stride. And I've said this before. I used to say after he got traded. Never quite found the level that I think he can play at with Minnesota. And I have a theory about that stuff. Sometimes you just get almost like being a freshman forever in college. You never really move up. I think Charlie Coyle is a guy that's going to do very well for the Minnesota, for the Boston Bruins, and I'm sure the Minnesota Wild are aware of that. They just felt like it's time for a change for their organization.
I couldn't tell what his ceiling was. I couldn't tell if he was a center or a wing, or if he could play both in the same season, if he had value doing both. What did you? I mean, should he have concentrated more on one or the other for the Wild, or was it a system thing that he never really became real productive offensively?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I've spent a lot of time talking to people, even a guy like Scotty Stevens, who I work with at NHL Network. And Scotty coached him, obviously, with the Minnesota Wild, not this year, but previous one. And he just had such great things to say about Charlie in the middle. I always envisioned him more as a wing. I think the jury's still out on what he's best at. But ultimately, for me, I see him as a winger. I see him as a guy that can be more effective when you take a little bit of pressure off him in terms of having to distribute the puck the way we ask our centers in the National Hockey League. But I see him potentially as a top six winger, definitely as a top nine winger. And I think he's going to be really good for a Bruins team that just by chance really needs to find somebody to play with Jake DeBrusk and David Krejci on that second line. That's probably where he'll fill in, but if the Bruins want to go the other way, they can easily use him as their third line center, and a hole they're also trying to fill. So ultimately, in the short term, I think this is a really good trade for the Boston Bruins because they're right there with the contenders in the East, but I still feel like they need a piece or two if they want to take down a team like the Tampa Bay Lightning or even a team like the Washington Capitals.
Sure. Now, you grew up in the shadows of Boston as well, like Coyle did, so you've got some similarities there. Give me just an idea. What's it like as a hockey market?
Boston's a fantastic hockey market, and I don't think you have as much density in terms of people that follow hockey as it is in Minnesota, but that's about the only difference. The fans are incredibly passionate in Boston. They love their Bruins teams. They love all their sports teams, but they really love the Bruins. And if not for the Bruins, I never would have played hockey, quite frankly. I grew up in Rhode Island, but only about 40 minutes from the Bruins. And I watched Bobby Orr and Phil Esposito. I didn't have anybody in my family that ever played hockey, but those guys, that team was the reason why I got into this crazy sport.
You know, along those lines, I never asked you this question before, but we had a couple of the 1980 Olympians in last night, Dave Christian and Rob McClanahan, guys you know well. Were you inspired by the 1980 Olympic team because you would have been an impressionable age at that point in time? Or were you well on your way in your hockey career, or did that do anything for you?
At that time, I was 14 years old, and I obviously had been engulfed by hockey well before that, but I absolutely was inspired by Davey, who's a good friend of mine, and guys I went on to play with in some Canada Cups and other events. But those guys were incredible for every young hockey player anywhere, really from 8 to 18 at that time, I think was inspired by Neil Broughton and Herb Brooks and so many other great names and people that I was fortunate enough to go on to meet and in some cases call them good friends. So, yes, it was incredibly inspirational, particularly at that time. It's hard to explain now. The world's in a different place, but Russia and the United States back then, there was a lot of turmoil. A lot of conflict.
Now, did you know guys like O'Callaghan, Craig, names that we came to know as Minnesotans that were from Boston area? Did you know them from their college career at all?
Davey Silk a little bit, but not many of them. They were just a little bit older than me. They weren't necessarily 4 years. A lot of those guys were 8. You know, they were seniors in college. I was 14. They were roughly 22. So I didn't know a lot of the Boston guys. Obviously, I played with Jim Craig after the Olympics on the North Stars and in a world championship even. And Jim's just an A-plus guy, as really is every single guy to a man on that team. It's no, you know, strange coincidence that they won. They just had a really great group of guys that were selfless. And ultimately, Herb did an incredible job of holding him accountable, and they figured out a way to pull off a miracle.
Back to the Wild for a minute. Why can't they score goals? What, give me a hockey reason as to why we're seeing what we're seeing with this team.
Well, there's no reason, you know, really technically why they can't score goals. I just think they lost their juju, to say the least. Confidence level isn't there. You know, it's really concerning to me when the coach comes out and makes a very, very aggressive statement that, you know, essentially the club is going to be in the playoffs, and then they respond the way they respond. And make no mistake, Paul Fenton is taking close note of that. What does that mean ultimately? We don't know. But clearly the Minnesota Wild have made a decision here, not unlike the St. Louis Blues last year, a team that was virtually in the same position, when they traded Paul Stastny to the Winnipeg Jets.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, the needs of the long-term plan outweigh the needs of the short-term. I commend them for that. I personally would do the same thing if I were the general manager. I might have started it earlier, to be honest with you. You may think that's crazy, but for me, you know, the National Hockey League, working in it, is only about one thing, and that's winning a Stanley Cup. Making the playoffs every year is nice. And someday I assume I'll go back and work for a club, but it'll only be under the premise that we're in it to win it, and I mean the Stanley Cup.
But here's my take on the Bruce Boudreau-Paul Fenton situation. Boudreau, a little nervous about him when he came in because he'd never worked with him before. There was no connection there. So already, and he's been through this enough times to know what it feels like to get fired. So he sees some of that stuff maybe rearing its head. He loses an assistant coach out of the deal that he likes very much. So there's kind of a shot across the bow there. So now he gets his team going, and they're winning to an extent. And he's not backed down from not just saying we're going to make the playoffs, but talking about what we need to do to make the playoffs all along. To me, what he's saying to Paul Fenton is, we're not playing for tomorrow, we're playing for today. Every statement he makes is about how do we get to the playoffs this year, because he knows, short of that, his job's in jeopardy. Do you read it that way?
I think that's a pretty fair assessment. You know, and Bruce is a great guy. He knows.
Oh, yeah, and he's been down the road before.
He knows Paul Fenton, but, you know, we all have an inner group of circle of friends. There's all kinds of connections everywhere in this game, but there's not a deep one, as far as I know, between Paul and Bruce, and that doesn't mean that the relationship can't work,
right?
But it's also not a good thing to start off a relationship with.
So if you're Boudreau, are you not right to say playoffs, because that's what you need to keep your job, number one, and number two, you want the general manager to bring you some more pieces? Or do you and the GM talk about all this stuff all the time?
Yeah, I mean, if Paul's a veteran guy in this business. He knows how it works. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, sometimes you inherit coaches, and if you're going to continue on with them, you got to give it a best faith effort to build a solid relationship with them. And you got to give them the autonomy to do what they need to do in terms of running the club. But ultimately, you're going to sit back and judge them on a couple of things. And I say this a lot on NHL Network, but there's two things that stand out for me with coaches. One is that they need to be able to convince the players they can make them better, enhance their careers. That's just a hallmark of today's players. They want to know that. They ask questions. They're more plugged in than when I played. And the second thing is players want to know that you can help hold a fair and accountable level of accountability in the locker room. And that's a really tough one to do, particularly when you have a somewhat veteran-laden team like the Minnesota Wild. But ultimately, Paul Fenton would be sitting back and judging Bruce on those things this year. And then the third one, of course, would be the structure that the team plays with. And I think Bruce has a long track record of proving that he knows how to organize and structure a team. So it's the other two that would be up for debate. And ultimately, you know, that's Paul's job to figure out where the Wild go. I mean, right now to me, Mike, it feels like there'll be another trade or two coming for the deadline.
Who would you put next on the list? Eric Staal?
I think that would probably be a pretty good guess. He's a guy that a lot of teams are going to want. He's an unrestricted free agent. He hasn't been re-signed. There's a lot of factors that would point you in that way, but I don't know. I haven't talked to Paul Fenton about that, but that would seem logical.
Yeah, and because you just look at, you know, big body like that, what everybody seems to be looking for, could always use somebody like that. But you mentioned something there in terms of getting veterans to buy in, et cetera, and know that, you know, the young guys are watching how you treat the veterans, and they want, you know, some of the same accountability. They want everybody to be held accountable, all those things. What kind of a conversation would you have with a coach when you're the GM about implementing that?
Well, the first thing I'd want to do is just get the coach's thoughts, particularly when you have a guy like Bruce that's been there for a number of years. What does he say? You know, there's a lot of great veterans in the National Hockey League, but probably the most overused statement that I find, having played in the league and having managed in the league and represented players, is he's a good guy. Everybody's a good guy, but yep, somehow you have to decipher through that and figure out who the winners are. And to me, most of the winners I ever played with or have had the good fortune to be around are selfless individuals. They put the team first. You could be a veteran guy that is making a ton of money and life is really good and go home every day and just stick to yourself, or you can be that guy that takes it upon himself to mentor the younger players. That's what, you know, Paul Fenton would want to have those types of discussions with Bruce Boudreau as to what his observations are. And then Paul's going to want to make his own mind up as to what he's being told, if it's accurate or not. So, you know, this is the private stuff that never gets talked about publicly that's really critical to how an organization functions and works. And Paul Fenton has a lot of experience in this coming from Nashville, learning from a guy like David Poile that's a veteran GM that's managed a club, quite frankly, longer than anybody, to the best of my knowledge, in the National Hockey League right now, and has been doing it well. And one of their hallmarks is that, you know, they do a fantastic job in Nashville just welcoming players to the organization, starting that family atmosphere off right. So we could go anyway on this conversation, Mike, but that's the reality of it.
Who do you think has done the best so far in the NHL in the trades?
In terms of trades, I think that everything that's happened so far, no disrespect to Charlie Coyle, is a warm-up for the Big Bang Theory until we see Matt Duchene, Mark Stone, and Artemi Panarin traded. There's still some angst in terms of what fair value is. The Brian Boyle trade by the Nashville Predators a couple of weeks ago really threw things out of whack, I thought, because that was a high price to play for Brian, a guy that's really a combination third, fourth line center. But David Coyle made the determination that that's what the Predators need, probably anticipating the potential matchup with the Winnipeg Jets, and went out and got the 6'7" center that provides great leadership and maybe even overpaid a little bit for it. But he wanted to get his business done early, and he did.
And last
you have a guy like Aaron Staal, who I think is a lot more valuable than Brian Boyle, but I'm not sure, you know, that teams are going to be jumping up and down to give you a first-round pick plus-plus like a Jake Muzzin got in the Toronto-LA trade. So the market's a little bit upside down right now, Mike, and I think that's what's slowing things down.
And last, Pittsburgh looks like a Minnesota team now. They had one more Minnesota player to go with Cullen and, of course, the Kessel connection and Gensel and, you know, Crosby a little bit with his Faribault Shattuck, but they had one more, and they've got fortified with Minnesotans.
Well, it's a great opportunity for my good friend Nick Bjugstad. I'm more friends with his uncle Scotty and his dad Mike, but I was really excited for the opportunity for Nick. I think he's going to do fantastic there. It's going to give him an opportunity to not to take or knock Florida, but just to learn from some guys in Malkin, particularly in Crosby, that are so professional. An opportunity that he really hasn't seen other than when Willie Mitchell was down there, but he would have influenced a guy like Aaron Ekblad more than Nick Bjugstad. So I'm fired up for him, and he's doing well so far, and he could be a real impact player for them, not only now, but come playoff time in the years to come as well.
Yeah, that looks like a gift for him. Hey, Brian, thank you so much for breaking it down and giving us time. Always appreciate it very much.
Anytime, Mike, stay tuned. We're going to have a big trade deadline day coverage on NHL Network on Monday.
Monday.
And then at 1 o'clock Minnesota time, we'll have all the trades. It'll be exciting.
And you don't think the Wild are done until that trade deadline bell rings, right?
I think the Wild have at least one more trade in them, if not two. But I also will tell you, it doesn't mean that the Wild are throwing the towel in on the season. You can make moves. And, you know, St. Louis almost made it last year after they traded Stastny and down to the final game of the season. So don't count the Wild out, but I think they're doing the right thing for their long-term future. I commend Craig Leopold for the leadership, because these are the toughest times when you own a franchise to step up and potentially take a step back to take two steps forward.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mike.
That's always fun, man. Brian Lawton. Go a lot of different directions, cover a lot of ground in a short period of time. Same with Jim Dutcher. He'll join us not far away. And when we come back, I'll talk about the importance of personal relationships and how they supersede professional relationships many, many times in sports. Stay with us. Let me explain why these things get murky and messy and defining to an extent. You know, we were just talking to Brian Lawton there about Paul Fenton, Bruce Boudreau. Don't really know each other beforehand. Boudreau's already there. Fenton comes in. Fenton may or may not have an image of what he wants to see a coach do, or a perception of, and Boudreau may or may not fit that. Here's where it gets messy. If Fenton wants to change the landscape and do things that would be in contrast to the way Bruce Boudreau would, he better be right. That's the big thing. Because it's not one of the biggest mistake that general managers make, that managers make, this probably isn't just in sports, this is in work too, is when they bring in somebody from their past that they have a relationship with, and they're not good enough. Because everybody on the existing team knows they're not good enough. So now they disrespect the person you brought in, plus they disrespect you for bringing them in. And you lose big time. And I've seen more careers go in the toilet by doing that. You bring in the person that was connected to you, right? You're comfortable with that person. Problem is, they don't have any talent. They're not good enough for the spot. So you bring them in as if no one's going to notice. Well, everybody notices, and everybody's watching to see, and why did you bring this person in? Is it a good fit? Blah, blah, blah. And if it's not a good fit, and it's somebody from your past, and it's somebody that you're comfortable with, not only will they ostracize that person, but they're going after you too. That's why these decisions are so critical, whether it's Paul Fenton or anybody, as to how you go about doing business. Because you bring in the wrong person, just, and if you had a relationship with them in the past, some reason, some place your paths crossed, your teammates in the American League, blah, 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 that's okay. But it's a double backfire. If they're not good enough to meet the standard that's set there, if they're not good enough, everybody on the team recognizes it. First they go after that person, then they go after you. Jim Dutcher, not far away. Stay with us. Welcome back, Sports to the Max. We got all the information here. We got all the great guests that you want. That's what we do. That's how we go about our business. Joining us right now, case in point, Jim Dutcher, former Golden Gopher coach, of course, and much more, breaking it all down. Jim, you should be in San Diego watching Brian's team right now, huh?
Well, they come on to it at 10 o'clock tonight. They play Nevada at home, a big game. It's a sold-out 12,500. Nevada, of course, is ranked 6th in the nation. So the game's on ESPN, so I will be watching them tonight.
Isn't that something? Musselman against Dutcher. Dutcher replaced Musselman at Minnesota, and 45 years later, we get to see it again, huh?
Can you believe that? The youngsters are going after it.
The youngsters. Nevada's got a nice team now, don't they?
They really do. It's a different roster, Mike. They got 5 senior transfers that are in their fifth year of basketball that are starting. And some really, really talented team. They went to the Sweet 16 last year before losing, but they're really, really a talented team.
You know, it's the back end of doing what Kentucky's done with the one-and-dones, isn't it? It's you're taking guys that you've seen that can play, and you might get them for 1 year, but you're okay with that.
Yeah, they've been there. This group has been together for 2 years now. J.C. Caroline's probably an All-American. They got the Martin twins at guards who transferred from North Carolina State. And so they're talented. Eric Musselman's done a great job of them. They're going for their third consecutive Mountain West Championship.
Yeah, yeah, they've got to go in the right direction. Now tomorrow night, Michigan comes to town, another team that you coached, very familiar with back in the day, and they come to play the Golden Gophers. Now, I have not been, when I've seen them in spurts and saw them against the Gophers, I have not been overly impressed by Michigan, even though their ranking and what they did last year and all those things would tell you they're a good basketball team.
They don't overwhelm you physically. They only had one player, Dan Teske, who's 6'10", 6'10 and a half on the inside. But other than that, they're perimeter players. Charles Matthews, Kentucky transfer, is about 6'7". Jordan Poole is 6'6". You know, Brzezinski, the Canadian freshman, is about 6'7". So they're not a big team. And Minnesota had a great chance to beat them in Ann Arbor and lost by that last-second basket by Matthews.
Yeah, it was a great game. I mean, it wasn't a great game. It wasn't really necessarily a great, well-played game. But Minnesota had a shot at the end. They came back and had a shot at the end. But early in the season, I thought Michigan, you know, they were up to number one or two in the country at one point in time.
Yeah, they're a team that went to the finals a year ago in the NCAA tournament. They have a number of players back off that team. They're not as good as they were a year ago. They lost Mo Wagner, who was first choice. They lost their starting point guard. But they're a steady team. They play great half-court defense, but you can hurt them on the boards. And I thought the Gophers did a great job of coming back. They were 10 down late in that game in Ann Arbor and got it tied up.
Yeah, that's right, and you get over that hump, you find a way to win. Give me some perspective on, you know, Michigan's got this great football tradition. Basketball, somehow, I don't want to call it in the background, but it doesn't seem to have the same fervor as football. What's it feel like in Michigan if you're part of the basketball program?
There's no question that football's number one. You know, the Big House and leading the nation in football attendance, their record through the years, national championships. In basketball, they've won it once. That was 1989 when Brian was the assistant and Steve Fisher was the head coach. They beat Seton Hall in the national championship game. They've been there a few other times.
Oh, yeah, the Fab Five, yeah.
Yeah, they won it. We saw them here in the NCAA finals when they lost to Duke not that many years ago. But there's no question that football is number one in Ann Arbor.
What was Bo Schembechler like?
Good. He was a guy who really backed the entire program, not just the football team. He was very, very accessible to the rest of the coaching staff. And Bo was just a good man and a good football coach.
Now the Gophers, we've talked about the point guard since the beginning of the season, and it's played out that way, especially in the Big Ten. If you have a good point guard, it sure helps. Can you do it by committee? Are they good enough here to do this by committee?
I don't think so. Michigan's got Xavier Simpson. He's really a good leader. He can score off the drive. He's a great defensive player. And if you say there's one guy they can't play without, I would say it's Xavier Simpson, their point guard. And that's pretty vital to having a great team. We see Jones at Duke, a freshman, leading that team. And
yeah, tonight they get North Carolina.
Yeah, when he was out with the injury, they weren't the same Duke team. Now they got him back, it makes a big difference. So point guard is a very, very important position in basketball.
I don't know how much you followed him, but I'm sure you have. McKinley Wright was sitting there at Champlain Park. He went to Colorado. He's been playing there for a couple of years as a point guard. The Gophers did not go after him. Some people thought they should have at the time. He looks like he would have been the perfect option in some respects. Tough kid, plays hard, plays the point, not afraid to rebound, all those things. Do you have an opinion? Did you see him, and do you think that would have been a good fit?
Yeah, he is an outstanding. He was Mr. Basketball in Minnesota. He made a commitment to Indiana, and then
Indiana. It was the coach that the Indiana coach was. Where did he come from again? From down there in Ohio.
Yeah,
Ohio University or whatever. Before he took the Indiana job.
Yeah, and so what that freed him up, and he was a late recruit to Colorado, and he's done a great job. I watched him the other night against Arizona, and he's really a good point guard.
Now, this transfer rule and this being able to get kids sometimes to come and be eligible immediately, are we just seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of the effect that's going to have on college basketball?
I think so, particularly, Mike, as you mentioned, the one-and-done teams. You look at Duke, five freshmen, and they'll probably all be gone next year. Kentucky, most of the, I think four of their five will be one-and-doneers this year. Kansas has a number of kids leave early. North Carolina's the same. The really, really top teams in the country, it's different now. They try to go after those players even though they're only going to be there for 1 year.
Well, Reed Travis got hurt against Missouri last night, but he's one of those as well from Stanford to Kentucky. What a nice addition he is for Kentucky. An older guy like that, smart, physical, tough. I mean, that was a great find for Calipari, but now Calipari's figured out how to play that angle.
Yeah, they needed him. Reed is a very good high school player. He had an outstanding career at Stanford. And as a fifth-year senior, he said, well, I'd like to compete for a national championship. He knew it wasn't going to happen at Stanford, and so Calipari recruited him to Kentucky, and he's a crucial part. I don't know how bad he is with his ankle sprain, but they're going to need him back if they're going to compete for a national title.
Yeah, for sure. The Big Ten as it's played out this year, now a lot of top 25 teams going into the season. And obviously somebody's going to lose. So, Indiana's lost a lot of games. Nebraska's lost a lot. They were a top 25 team. Obviously, that's going to play itself out during the course of it. But there's this new algorithm, if you will, that they're using to determine NCAA tournament teams. Do you think the Big Ten is going to really prosper from that?
Yeah, they will this year. Last year was complete reverse. They got four teams in. And Nebraska won 13 conference games and did not get in the tournament. This year, some team that isn't 500 in the conference is going to get in the tournament because they're the number one ranked conference in the country. Michigan, Michigan State, Purdue, Wisconsin, Maryland, Iowa are probably in now. They just got to keep from falling flat on their face. Ohio State and Minnesota are talked about as also being tournament teams, but I think both of those teams got some work to do. The Gophers have to get a signature win. Right now, their signature win was at Wisconsin in Washington in the non-conference season because Washington's leading the Pac-12. But the conference schedule, Mike, really sets up for the Gophers. They got Michigan, Purdue, both teams they lost to on the road, coming here to Williams Arena. They got Rutgers, Northwestern, and Maryland on the road. Conceivably, Maryland's going to be tough. Maryland beat them in Williams Arena. You look at Northwestern, you say probably. Rutgers is really playing good basketball now.
Yeah.
They lost to Iowa on a freak shot as time expired. But they need to, I think, they've got to win one of those, Michigan or Purdue. They played Michigan well. They did not play well in West Lafayette. But if they win one of those, and at least one of their non-conference games on the road, I think they're in the tournament.
Well, the way Coach Pitino explains it is, losses are not a big deal in the NCAA formula. It's just how many quality wins you have.
Yeah, the way that's set up now, this net assessment, it depends on who you play, where you play them, and what the score is. If you lose by more than 10, that's a negative. But if you play a Michigan or a Michigan State and lose close, your rating actually goes up, even with a loss. And so the new system, Mike, definitely favors the power conferences. And last year, four Big Ten teams in the tournament. This year, a minimum seven, maybe eight in the tournament.
When you had your great team at Minnesota, you had a few of them, but the one with Ray Williams, Flip Saunders, Osborne Lockhart, Michael Thompson, Kevin McHale, that year you couldn't go to the tournament. You were already had been on probation because of some of the things that Coach Musselman had done before that. But as I recall, you beat Marquette, who won the national championship. And what did you have? Did you lose to Michigan twice during the season? Was that in the Big Ten?
We lost to Michigan twice, and we lost in double overtime to Purdue. At Purdue, those were our three losses. And of course, that Michigan team a year later went on and played for the national championship that season against Indiana. The first time in NCAA history that two teams from the same conference played for a national title. So we were 15-3 in the conference, and even if we would have got in if we were eligible, but because of the probation that you mentioned, we could not go.
So you beat Indiana a couple times.
Yeah, it was a good basketball team. The front line three were all first round draft choices. The first player picked, the third player picked, and the ninth player picked.
That'll get you some wins.
McHale and Thompson. And then Flip was the perfect college point guard. Osborne Lockhart played the off guard, and Osborne played 13 years with the Globetrotters. And there was a lot of talent on that ball club.
Yeah, Osborne had a great record with the Globetrotters. I think he hardly ever lost.
Yeah, they're playing here this summer. And he's getting his into the Globetrotter Hall of Fame during that game.
Oh, good.
Osborne's coming to town. They give him a commemorative watch that they award to him, and he's in the Globetrotter Hall of Fame. And that's going to happen this summer in Minneapolis.
Oh, wow. Let me know when that's going to happen. That'd be a good story to do.
Yeah, it will be a good story.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that the two of those guys are no longer with us, Flip and Ray.
Yeah, that's... That's life. It's very, very unfortunate with Ray and Flip. But not many teams have two players on the same team to go on to be head coaches in the NBA like Kevin McHale and Flip did. And they're a group that was very, very close. And so that's one of the joys, Mike, to follow guys' career after they leave your college team.
Yeah, and to watch Michael and his sons and what's happened with them.
Yeah, no, that's one of the joys of coaching.
Well, we appreciate you very much, Coach. Always enjoy the game tonight, San Diego State and Nevada.
Thanks, Mike.
You bet, Jim Dutcher. What a class act he is. Huh? One of the great joys that I've had in my life since I've been in this business is there are pockets of groups that unofficial groups that you kind of belong to. It's not the Kiwanis Club. It's not the Rotary Club. It's not the whatever. But every so often you get together for lunch. And for whatever reason, these groups have nothing to do with each other. And yet, it's kind of funny because Dave Lee and I end up in all these different pockets of people because we know the same people even though they're from different communities. And one of those groups, and Jim Dutcher is a part of it. Just every once in a while we'll get together and have a lunch. And Dick Ames, who just passed away, was in that group. And you sit there and you just visit and listen, and it's just remarkable. It's so much fun to sit and listen to Jim Dutcher. He's such a nice man, and these other guys. And what's nice for me is I'm still a young guy in any of these groups, and that's really nice. It's nice to feel young. And so I don't have to talk at all. I just sit and listen. And I've learned more things, had more laughs, and more good people, more good relationships hanging out with those people over the years. It's just... It's one of the small joys, but one of the perks that I never anticipated when I got into this job, because, you know, it's always about people, and to be able to just let your guard down, hang out with some of these people, you can learn an awful lot if you keep your mouth shut, as they say. Take a break, come back, Sports to the Max on WCCO. I hope he doesn't steal all the good Oscars talk. Oh, I have to talk about it. Welcome back, Sports to the Max. Mike Max, News Talk 830 WCCO. Keeping you abreast of all that is pertinent in sports. So when you play Division I, this is what I think is kind of a just reward, this transfer rule, where these kids are leaving and they're going around and you can't follow them and they're transferring here and there. You know, coaches at the Division I level, to an extent, are transactional. They want you because you offer a skill set and you fit a piece to the puzzle, and if you don't fit what they want, then they'll try to run you off the team. Well, back in the day, some of the coaches thought that was okay. Well, now some of the players are saying, you know what, coach? I'm gone. I'm going to go play my last year somewhere else because I'm going to be a grad transfer. And now they have to live with that piece of it. And I think that's kind of, I don't want to say that the players have gotten vengeance, but to an extent they have. They've made it difficult on the coaches to try to keep tabs and keep people happy. But that should take them out of being a transactional coach and more into being a transformational coach, where you actually get to know your players and you care about them and you do things with them and for them. And you have to nurture them and create something where they're loyal to you. It used to always be a one-way street. Kid comes in. If the coach leaves, the kid still can't transfer without sitting out a year. Even though he came to play for that coach, even though whatever, all the rules are skewed against the kids. Now the rules are in the kids' favor, and they're going, see you, coach. And it's kind of interesting to watch, you know, at all levels. Football, too. These grad transfers, they provide interesting debates. And, you know, Russell Wilson was the first one. He was the one that really made it all famous. He came into Wisconsin and just lit it up. And everybody said, well, if you can get that. And then Wisconsin tried again with another quarterback. It didn't work out so well. And usually it doesn't, so you got to be right. But Russell Wilson was the one that got everybody thinking that way. On the other side, we're going to visit with Dr. Johnny Tower. And what's interesting about him is he's not just the basketball coach at the University of St. Thomas. He has his PhD in psychology. And so these topics that I just broached autonomously, we will bring up with him and allow his participation on it. What is it? You know, is anybody really a transformational coach, or is everybody kind of a transactional coach? And is that maybe, in some respects, the easiest way to go about your business, because you just say, here's what I expect of you. Nothing personal, but either you make the grade or you don't. I don't know. His team is still alive. They play Augsburg tomorrow night. This Copeland kid, we featured him. David McCoy did feature him yesterday at 6. He's a great player for Augsburg, and he also does the laundry literally for the team. Literally does the laundry after the game because part of his work-study program. And the game was tied in the last seconds, and he makes a three-pointer as time runs out. And Augsburg wins the game last night. It was really fun stuff. So now they play St. Thomas tomorrow night as part of the playoffs. St. John's plays Bethel. But it's always fun to talk to Johnny, Dr. John, about all that goes into it. You know, he's also a parent. And I don't know. I don't know philosophically what his philosophies are with his team and the way he handles players, et cetera. But I wonder how much of that involves psychology. I don't know. I guess I've never really, you know, I just got to be careful, right? Because if you play too many games, psychological games with kids, if they become aware of it, then they go, okay, I get this now. That's not cool. You know, you're trying to play me here, blah, blah, blah. So it's always a fine line because the kids are so in tune with, just like people are in tune with their boss, kids are in tune with the coach, and they're always watching every move that they make and probably over-reacting to a lot of it. But we'll visit with Johnny about just that because he deals with it on a daily basis. 5 seconds, Susan?
You've got a
minute. Oh, is it 58-20?
58-20.
Okay, and then Sam Rosen is going to join us at 8:35. He calls some games for the New York Rangers, the Wild play there tomorrow night. So he'll join us at 8:35, talk a little bit about that and what's going on in the Big Apple as he sees it. That's all straight ahead. Timberwolves went back to work tonight. They practiced tonight, And they will play again right here in the Big Apple. How many times have I said this? One team from Minnesota plays there, then another team from Minnesota plays there. Tomorrow night, the Wild will play at Madison Square Garden. The next night, the Timberwolves will play at Madison Square Garden. We saw this with the Vikings and Timberwolves in Detroit. We've seen this time after time in Los Angeles with the Kings and the Timberwolves. It's nothing more than interesting and coincidental. But for two nights, Minnesota will take center stage at Madison Square Garden. Timberwolves will be there fulfilling their obligation on Friday night. Going to be interesting to see if they can make any kind of a push. If they do, you'll hear it right here on WCCO. Johnny Tower, when we come back, News Talk 830 WCCO.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.